Hello, and welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. On today's program, I'll be reading a collection of stories and articles addressing disability-related issues, including a piece from the New York Times about the first severely disabled author in Japan to win a top literary prize, an article from the Tucson Sentinel about the alarming trend of private equity firms acquiring disability and elder care providers in recent years. You'll hear a piece by Sarah Minkara, a former special advisor on international disability rights, calling for a societal shift in perceptions of people with disabilities. And I'll begin with this article from the New York Post, entitled Game Changer. Long Island Smart Home opens with appliances and automatic features for those with disabilities, by Alex Mitchell, published May 26, 2025. It's a brilliant concept. A new smart home for those with disabilities opened on Long Island and has quickly become a game changer for the everyday lives of its residents. If it wasn't for this house, I wouldn't be as independent as I am now, 33-year-old A.J. Duran, who recently moved into the Shirley property in Suffolk County, told The Post. The four-bedroom property, which is operated by the locally operated organization FREE, a.k.a. Family Residences and Essential Enterprises, has been decked out with high-tech appliances and voice-controlled utilities for residents to make the most of, rather than calling for the home's aides to handle minuscule tasks. Its sink, refrigerator, stovetops, oven, and blinds are all Bluetooth-controlled and can be remotely turned on and off for residents from different communities across LI. The oven door opens sideways rather than top to bottom, making it possible for wheelchair users to cook in it, while the sink and stovetop are vertically adjustable at the simple touch of a button. People who perhaps could benefit the most from modern technology often have the least access to it, Free's CEO Robert Budd said of the thousands kicked in to making the April open house electronically sophisticated. He added that homes like this, especially on Long Island, are few and far between, and that the facility's success is moving FREE toward opening more. The house's upgrades were funded through Medicaid, and its sink, stove, blinds, and oven were the priciest features at several thousand dollars combined. Other features, like the linking of Amazon Alexa devices, individual climate controls for each room, and likewise smart devices, were comparatively cost-efficient, Bud added. This home was our commitment to making sure that these people could have greater autonomy. That kind of independence leads to greater emotional well-being, and greater emotional well-being leads to greater overall health. Duran, who has cerebral palsy and relies on a wheelchair for mobility, is making the most of the easy-to-use gadget inside her home's new kitchen. It's opened so many doors and things for me that I couldn't be able to do before. Now I have access to the kitchen. I can make a sandwich on my own, Duran said. Using an Alexa device to learn recipes at a workstation in the kitchen, Duran is now discovering for the first time that she has a culinary passion. She's been cooking up a storm with dinners like pasta and meat sauce, turkey in a smart air fryer, and taco nights for her roommates. I'm loving my independence and not having to ask people to do me a meal, she said. This new house and everything in it is really the best thing FREE has ever done for people like me. Alyssa Slade, who is moving in on Wednesday, is most looking forward to the easy-access multimedia aspect of the home, which has Amazon Alexa devices in each room. Everything in here is so beautiful, the 32-year-old with autism said while touring her new residence on Monday. I love music. I love music videos, and I like TV shows. That's the most exciting part for me. The home's on-site supervisor, Deborah Brock, said that innovative equipment is already changing the demeanor of the two residents who Slade and one other will join in the coming weeks. It's really exciting, especially for AJ. She comes and goes when she wants, eats when she wants, and has access to everything for herself, Brock said. It's encouraging these people to do more for themselves than depend on others for assistance. It's definitely a switch, definitely a game changer. This next article comes from Archaeology News, and it's entitled, Medieval Man with Crippled Knee Reveals Disability Care in Sweden, by Dario Radley, published May 17, 2025. A recent archaeological study in southern Sweden has revealed new insights into the medieval disability experience. The study by Lund University researchers has examined a skeleton belonging to a man who had a disabling knee injury, revealing both the harsh realities and the unexpected compassion that characterized medieval disability attitudes. Published in Open Archaeology, the study centers on individual 2399, a man in his mid-30s who lived between 1300 and 1536 CE. His skeleton was discovered in Lund, a historic city in southern Sweden. The man had suffered a serious fracture and dislocation of his left knee as the result of some traumatic incident, such as a horse kick or a dropped heavy object, presumably on the site where he used to work. This injury made it impossible for him to walk unaided for the rest of his life. Led by Blair Nolan of Lund University, the team took a multidisciplinary approach through the use of traditional osteological analysis, digital excavation records, historical documents, and advanced 3D modeling. It was the first time this method was applied to medieval remains in the Nordic region. Deducing social norms regarding physical impairment and disability from religious and legal texts is difficult because they present an idealized perspective, Nolan said in a press release. We can enrich our understanding of disability and identity through detailed osteological and archaeological analysis. The man's skeleton shows obvious short and long-term care. He would have received pain management immediately following his injury with ointments containing ingredients such as lavender oil, opium, and alcohol. He appears to have been repeatedly treated for osteomyelitis, a painful infection of the bone, meaning that his caregivers opened up the wound and drained it regularly. These medical interventions would have required access to resources, meaning that he was not impoverished. Indeed, his burial place attests to his relatively high status in society. Individual 2399 was interred atop the foundation stones at the base of a church tower, a prestigious spot usually reserved for wealthier citizens, particularly those from the burgher class. In medieval Sweden, proximity to sacred buildings, like churches, in burial practices, signified a person's status and respect within society. The study also draws on legal and religious contexts in order to provide an account of broader societal attitudes towards disability at the time. Christian doctrine was ambivalent. Disability might be seen as a divine punishment or test. The church, however, had a dominant role in care, collecting alms, and running monastic hospitals. Legal codes, however, were harsh. Amputation of the limbs was a punishment that created associations between crime and disability. Society's attitudes also often assessed disabilities based on their visibility. Those injuries that could be hidden with hair or clothing were not seen as severe or stigmatizing. Despite the cultural prejudices in society at the time, the man's story is a reminder that compassion and sustained care for the disabled were not absent in medieval society. Surviving for a few years after he was injured, as well as his prominent burial location, suggests that he did have a respected position in his community. The evidence tends to indicate that while theological and legal texts conveyed hard or punitive attitudes toward disability, ordinary societal practice may have been more accommodating and supportive, particularly to individuals of higher status. And now from the New York Times, an undaunted writer who broke an invisible barrier in Japan. Sao Ichikawa is the country's first severely disabled author to win a top literary prize. Her novel, Hunchback, is an angry cry against ableist machismo. By Martin Fackler. May 15, 2025. When Sao Ichikawa was named the winner of the Octagawa Prize in July 2023, one of Japan's oldest and most prestigious literary awards, she flashed a thumbs up to her parents and editor before going on stage to receive it in front of a gold screen. While the 45-year-old novelist was the 181st winner of the prize, she was the first to require a ramp to ascend the stage. Ms. Ichikawa has congenital myopathy, a muscle disorder that requires her to use a wheelchair for mobility and a ventilator to breathe, and was the first author with a severe physical disability to win. She used her moment in the national spotlight to highlight how people with disabilities face isolation and are invisible in society, a theme she took up in her prize-winning novel, Hunchback. I wrote this novel thinking that it is a problem that there were few authors with disabilities, she told reporters, pressing a button on her larynx to speak. Why did the first winner not appear until 2023? I want everyone to think about that. It was a long journey for Ms. Ichikawa, who was removed from school after being put on the ventilator at age 13. But she refused to disappear, becoming an author in her 20s in an effort to reclaim a voice in society. For two decades, she wrote more than 30 pulp romance and fantasy stories meant for young readers, but all of her manuscripts were rejected. In 2019, when she enrolled in an online degree program at Waseda University, one of Japan's top schools, she began thinking about how people with disabilities are rarely represented in literature. She resolved to change that by telling the story of a character like herself, reliant on a wheelchair and a ventilator because of a major disability. Hunchback, her first work in which she said she took up a serious topic, bared a part of her experience for readers to see. There were only very stereotyped representations of the disabled, and I wanted to break that, Ms. Ichikawa said in an interview at the home of her parents with whom she lives. I wanted to show that we are people, too, with a diverse range of personalities and desires. These include sexual desires, which her main character, a woman named Shaka, who has a similar muscle disorder, uses to assert control over her own life and to seek revenge on a society that tries to deny her humanity. Through Japan's history, disabilities and illness were seen as something shameful to be kept hidden, Ms. Ichikawa said. When pregnant women passed by people with severe disabilities, they were told to show a mirror to ward off evil spirits. She stuck with writing, despite many setbacks, because she had no other way to be heard. Still, Ms. Ichikawa, who writes on an iPad, never imagined that her first work of pure literature would win a top prize. When I heard, my mind froze, she said. I think I was accepted because of my novelty, but I hope I can open the way for others to write more freely. Ms. Ichikawa's breakthrough comes as Japan is becoming more aware of what is called ableism, the assumption that society belongs to the able-bodied. In 2019, two people with severe disabilities won election to Japan's parliament, where renovations were required to accommodate their wheelchairs. Her winning the Akutagawa Prize has made a lot of people suddenly see the invisible barriers, said Yuki Aria, a professor of literature at Nishogakusha University. Hunchback is a shout of anger at a society that doesn't realize it's denying them participation. The most frequently cited passage of Ms. Ishikawa's book is a rant by the main character who wants to read but cannot grasp a book in her hands. In a burst of angry self-loathing, Shaka blames an ableist machismo that blinds most people to the barriers shutting out those with disabilities. Able-bodied Japanese people have likely never even imagined a hunchback monster struggling to read a physical book, Shaka says. Although she was born with her illness, Ms. Ichikawa was healthy as a young child, enjoying dance and gymnastics in elementary school. Knowing that her condition could worsen, her parents took her on trips to Thailand and Canada. After Ms. Ishikawa started requiring a wheelchair and ventilator, her parents built a home by the coast so she could still see the ocean. She said this was nevertheless a dark time when she was plagued by nightmares, including one in which her floor was littered with the carcasses of dead bugs. Later, she read in a book on dreams that this reflected a fear of being left behind. Despite multiple book rejections, Ms. Ichikawa didn't give up, saying she had nothing else to do. Hunchback has exceeded her dreams with an English translation recently released. Now that she has ascended to a bigger stage, Ms. Ichikawa has no intention of leaving it. I plan to go on a rapid-fire spree of writing spontaneous novels for the next few years, she said. I want to break preconceptions and prejudices. Next up is a piece from the Braille Monitor, the May 2025 edition, entitled Beyond the Chatbot, Innovations in the Fast-Changing World of AI, by Jonathan Mosen. From the editor. Jonathan Mosen is well known to Monitor readers, but he now writes in his capacity as Executive Director for Accessibility Excellence of the National Federation of the Blind. In this article, he shares his insights about the rapidly proliferating artificial intelligence, AI, tools that help us manage our everyday lives, some of which are designed or have benefits for blind people. Jonathan, sometimes with the help of other staff at our Center for Excellence in Non-Visual Accessibility, CENA, shares more insights, interviews, and technology news on the Federation's weekly Access On podcast, and he and the CENA team are also primarily responsible for managing and developing relationships with key players in the technology industry, including some of the AI companies mentioned here, in order to share the expertise and lived experience of blind Americans. Here is what Jonathan has to say about some of the latest AI tools. On November 30, 2022, a little-known San Francisco-based company, OpenAI, launched a free research preview of a tool called ChatGPT. Within 5 days, it had attracted over 1 million users, an unprecedented rate of adoption, representing a significant shift in public engagement with artificial intelligence. Users were struck by its ability to generate coherent, contextually aware responses across a wide range of topics, from composing essays to writing code and engaging in thoughtful dialogue. For many, it represented a major leap forward, an AI system that felt not only useful, but accessible and intuitive. Since then, generative AI has advanced at a remarkable pace. Models have become more capable, handling longer and more complex inputs, integrating real-time web access, image generation, and even multimodal reasoning that combines text, vision, and audio. This technology is still far from perfect. The abundance of AI-generated content requires us to be savvy, vigilant consumers. AI can still produce plausible-sounding but incorrect information, commonly known as hallucinations. While AI has delivered tangible benefits to blind people, there are also risks. In the National Federation of the Blind, we know the truth about blindness. It is not blindness that holds us back, but rather outmoded stereotypes that translate into lack of opportunity. Generative AI is like a giant sponge, soaking up all the material on the internet. In that material, you will find plenty of inaccurate information about blindness and blind people. It is critical that we correct these models so they depict blindness accurately. AI is now finding its way into all walks of life, from tools to help make job recruitment selections to tools that help design public policy. So, while a chatbot dispensing inaccurate stereotypes about blind people is bad enough, there are many other far-reaching consequences of AI not being informed about blindness. We are heartened by the commitment of all the major players in the AI industry to responsible, ethical AI when it comes to the depiction of blind people. In my personal use of AI, it has thankfully been some time since I have encountered an expression of sympathy from a large language model when I told it I was a blind person. Several AI companies are collaborating with services blind people use every day to obtain quality data about what it is like to be blind. The National Federation of the Blind is often at the table when these projects are being scoped, and I am encouraged by some of the products blind people will be using soon because of our direct involvement. Large language models possess a lot of information. We extract that information by asking the AI a question or giving it some sort of instruction. Designing these inputs is known as prompt engineering. Giving the AI a clear, specific instruction can make all the difference in the quality of the output it produces. If you are interested in this topic, the Federation's Center of Excellence in Non-Visual Accessibility recently produced a webinar on prompt engineering. You can hear or read the transcript of an abridged version of it in episode 16 of the NFB's technology podcast, Access On. Many of us are already using blindness-specific AI tools regularly, particularly for scene or image description, including Be My AI from Be My Eyes, Access AI from Aira, which offers the ability to obtain free verification of AI's findings via a professional agent, and PictureSmart, which is built into JAWS, J-A-W-S. There are intriguing AI tools emerging all the time. Here are a few that illustrate how AI is impacting every aspect of our lives. My mentioning of these tools does not constitute an endorsement by the National Federation of the Blind. I draw them to your attention in case you are curious to try one of these services so you can determine if they prove useful to you. First, let's discuss AI's ability to simplify complex research tasks. Conducting research is time-consuming for everyone, but it may be more frustrating for a blind person because some of the information we want might be on an inaccessible website. New technology offered by generative AI called deep research can circumvent those accessibility barriers. The two most common deep research tools are from ChatGPT and Gemini. Simply visit the websites or use the app for the service in question. If you have access to the deep research tool, you will find a button near where you enter a query labeled as such. Simply press the button to toggle deep research on. Type your query and submit it in the usual way. When you use deep research, your AI service of choice explores, synthesizes, and summarizes information from extensive, complex sources beyond surface-level facts. Unlike traditional search engines or basic AI tools, generative AI performing deep research can analyze large quantities of data, interpret context, and identify nuanced insights, such as hidden patterns, subtle trends, or meaningful relationships among topics. This process involves the AI going beyond straightforward keyword searches, instead delving into multiple layers of interconnected data, including academic papers, industry reports, historical records, and diverse media. The AI can then output coherent, insightful summaries or detailed explanations that previously would have required extensive human effort and considerable time. Deep research also provides detailed citations so you can consult the original sources if you wish. It is still necessary to exercise caution because sometimes the summarization process can yield inaccurate results. Yet overall, I have had outstanding results from deep research, particularly the one offered by ChatGPT. It is quite extraordinary, even if a little eerie, to watch it thinking about the task you have set it, looking at sources, reasoning about whether that source is relevant to the task it has been assigned, and growing in understanding about what it is finding. Sometimes, deep research takes a long time thinking about the task it has been set, but it is usually worth the wait. Recently, I was in the market for a new smart scale after the company producing my previous scale went out of business. I gave the deep research function of ChatGPT and Google's Gemini the same extensive prompt, telling them that I was seeking a smart scale that had compatibility with Apple Health, an app accessible with VoiceOver on iOS, the ability to collect data well beyond weight, such as body fat percentage and hydration, and if possible, provided some sort of haptic or audible feedback when the weighing process was complete. Both deep research tools went to work and produced comprehensive reports with slightly different recommendations. This process saved me considerable time. I didn't have to perform repeated searches and try to keep all the information in my head or take copious notes. In another example, I asked Gemini's deep research to produce a guide on using the Ecobee thermostat that my wife Bonnie and I have in our new Baltimore apartment, mindful that I use VoiceOver on an iPhone. This can be a useful strategy for getting information about new appliances, because many online or printed manuals use graphical symbols while describing buttons to press or steps to take. ChatGPT's deep research feature is excellent, but there is no free tier available. If you subscribe to ChatGPT Plus for $20 per month, you get 10 deep research queries per month. If you haven't paid for Google Gemini, you have limited access to deep research. Google appears not to have published the specifics of how many deep research queries you are allowed on the free tier, but users suggest it is around 5 per month. If you subscribe to Google One, which includes access to Gemini's advanced features for $19 per month, you seem to get many deep research queries with your plan. I'm now going to pause from this article to remind you that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now, back to our article. Another useful research tool from Google is called Notebook LM, available at https://notebooklm.google.com. Notebook LM allows users to organize, summarize, and interact with personal research materials and documents, enhancing productivity and understanding. It has not always been the most accessible of sites, and we would like to see accessibility improve further, but the site has improved since its initial release. Users begin by creating a digital notebook and uploading up to 50 sources, ranging from PDFs and Google Docs to websites and YouTube videos, with a combined limit of 25 million words. Notebook LM then uses artificial intelligence to summarize documents, generate concise explanations, and respond to queries based on the uploaded content. Let's say, for example, that you are interested in accessible televisions. You've watched some YouTube clips, read a few blog posts, and looked at many product descriptions. Once you provide Notebook LM with all this content, you can ask questions about it, as if you were talking to a large language model. The answers it returns will be based solely on the material you provided. As an experiment, I created a new notebook and uploaded every presidential report delivered by President Riccobono. I was then able to ask questions about the Federation during the Riccobono presidency and get accurate results. One of the most intriguing features of Notebook LM is its ability to generate podcast-style audio overviews. These take the form of two AI personas who sound quite human-like, discussing the subject matter in question. It's easy to download this audio and copy it to a device such as a media player or note taker. It's a fun way to distill complex topics. The summary it produced of the work of the NFB was engaging and accurate. Google has also added the audio overview feature of Notebook LM to Gemini, so you can upload content such as documents and slides to Gemini, then press the Generate Audio Overview button. Finally, let's look at the impact AI is having on shopping and a product specifically designed for blind people. Featured in Episode 8 of Access On, InnoSearch is a platform designed to make shopping easier for blind people. It aggregates over 500,000 retailers, from large players like Amazon and Walmart to smaller niche stores. Simply enter what you want in the search field, and InnoSearch will come back with matches from a variety of stores. This has accessibility benefits because, as we all know, some stores are more accessible than others. InnoSearch prioritizes results based on the best price. Another powerful feature of InnoSearch is the ability to query AI about the products it finds. It will also describe pictures of the products, and you can ask questions about those pictures. For example, when shopping for certain audio cables, it was very important to me to know precisely what type of plug was on the cable. InnoSearch was clear about this and ensured I got the correct cable the first time. There are some downsides at the moment. While InnoSearch is an accessible, efficient experience, you may not be able to leverage the benefit of store-specific programs like Amazon Prime. Amazon features like Subscribe and Save are not available. These are trade-offs that you may be willing to make, at least in certain circumstances, for an experience that is very easy to use. Customer service is excellent and responsive. Recently, I ordered a specific MagSafe battery for my iPhone that shipped from China. It took a long time to arrive. InnoSearch was monitoring the purchase, noticed it was taking a while, and followed up with the retailer without me having to ask. That was exceptional service. On the website, InnoSearch uses its technology for two product categories, shopping and flight search. The company is considering adding new categories in the future. The most exciting use of AI from InnoSearch is a version of the service that can be used over the phone. To use it, call toll-free 1-855-SHOP-GPT, 855-746-7478. Shopping hands-free with your voice is beneficial to everyone, but this is a particularly compelling use of AI because most blind people become blind later in life, and some don't wish to learn to use a computer or smartphone non-visually. This is an excellent concept in early development, with a few wrinkles at the time I am writing this article in April 2025. Sometimes, speaking the name of a product you're searching for yields relevant, clear results. You can ask to hear more information about any of the choices offered, add one to your cart, and check out. Other searches I tried were less successful. When I searched for the Zoom H6 Essential Handy Recorder, InnoSearch thought I was saying Zoo, not Zoom, no matter how clearly I enunciated. It also stripped part of my search, so it came back with searching for Zoo H Handy Recorder, which didn't deliver the results I wanted. Hopefully, this will improve over time, as it's great when it works and opens online shopping to a neglected market segment. We'll have more to say on new AI tools in a seminar at National Convention in New Orleans. We hope to see you there. The National Federation of the Blind is monitoring developments and having input into much of this innovative new technology. For further information, subscribe to Access On wherever you get podcasts. This next article comes from Zetio. It's entitled, "I Don't Need You to Cure My Blindness." The former Special Advisor on International Disability Rights calls for a societal shift towards valuing diverse experiences and fostering environments so people with and without disabilities thrive. By Sarah Minkara, May 22, 2025. Sarah, my goal is to cure your blindness. As I sat across from one of the many world leaders I met during my tenure as U.S. Special Advisor on International Disability Rights, I took a breath and considered my response. My goal, I replied, is for you to create a world where I can exist as a blind person. His words encapsulated a widespread belief that disability is a disadvantage, something to be fixed. To him, my existence as a blind person was a life unfulfilled, one lived in anticipation of a cure. This perspective, deeply ingrained in many political and social narratives, suggests that disabilities are deficits requiring eradication. Some officials have even claimed that autism destroys families and framed conditions like autism as epidemics to be eliminated. This rhetoric echoes historical abuses against disabled people, setting off alarm bells for autistic advocates. Disability advocates have long fought for systemic change to create a more equitable society, yet they continue to encounter deep-rooted resistance and structural obstacles. Federal funding for vital organizations offering advocacy and legal aid is on the verge of being cut by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, only 0.1% of major foundation funding goes toward advancing system-level change for people with disabilities. too often, disabled individuals are perceived as vulnerable and burdensome to both society and their families. We are expected to ask ourselves, don't we want to reduce the burden on our communities? We should strive to become disability-free. This mindset ignores a fundamental truth. Disability is a natural part of the human experience. It's not a question of if, but when. If we're lucky enough to live long lives, most of us will experience some form of disability through aging, injury, or illness. But it's also important to recognize that disability is not one size fits all. It manifests differently for everyone, and that distinction is key to understanding the full spectrum of experiences. No two people with the same type of disability experience barriers in the same way. I understand that many people living with chronic illness or chronic pain seek and advocate for a cure every day. That's why it's helpful to distinguish between identity-forming and non-identity-forming disabilities. For me, my blindness is an integral part of who I am. That's not to say I don't face barriers on a daily, if not hourly, basis. It can be frustrating, exhausting, and annoying, but I don't want to change my blindness. I want society to break down barriers that lead to these frustrations and inaccessibility. For example, people with disabilities are about twice as likely to be unemployed as non-disabled people. Reasons for the disparity have to do with barriers persons with disabilities face to employment. These barriers can manifest at any and all stages of the employment journey, from accessing education, transportation, and the digital world, to navigating job applications, interviews, workplace accommodations, and organizational culture. These pervasive barriers lead to higher unemployment and underemployment, limiting leadership opportunities, and preventing organizations from benefiting from our full contributions. This is a significant loss for society and the economy. Dismantling barriers. The dominant culture lens often frames disability as a burden rather than recognizing the true issue, the barriers we face. As a result, some reject their disability identity, yet whether one identifies as disabled, dismantling these barriers benefits us all and is essential to living a full life. For me, my disability taught me to navigate life innovatively. I became a better communicator, listener, and even a better math major. My disability informed my diplomatic approach. Without the distraction of written materials, I engage authentically in conversations, focusing on connection rather than memorization. It is not a deficit, but a significant asset that has afforded me my unique perspective. Without my disability, I would have never been able to accomplish all that I have and recognize the beauty and value of my disability identity. If I consistently saw my blindness as something wrong with me to be fixed, or if I was waiting on a cure, I would have never embraced all of who I am. I would have never innovated as a communicator, listener, mathematician, and diplomat. So, how do we dismantle the societal barriers that inhibit people with disabilities from embracing their identity and living their potential? Imagine a society where investment was directed toward removing these barriers. Not only would this empower individuals with disabilities, but it would also create a more inclusive environment for everyone. As a math major in college, my fellow students were eager to register for the same classes as me because when I was in class, the professors had to be better teachers and figure out ways to deliver the information to me in a non-visual manner. This is an example of the curb cut effect. Curb cuts were designed for wheelchair users, but they benefit anyone who needs to get from the street to a sidewalk easily. Ultimately, we must shift the focus from seeking cures to dismantling barriers that perpetuate exclusion. We need a societal shift toward valuing diverse experiences and fostering environments where authenticity and innovation thrive. for people with and without disabilities. Companies are starting to understand the value and innovation that people with disabilities bring to their work. Microsoft's neurodiversity hiring program builds upon the belief that neurodivergent employees bring innovative and creative solutions to the table precisely because they think and operate in diverse ways. But while programs like this exist, many are at risk of being cut due to backlash against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. People with disabilities are usually not included in DEI initiatives, but are lumped in and demonized when DEI is attacked. We must continue to challenge perceptions that people with disabilities are less capable and work toward a society that is not only accessible to us, but thrives because of our contributions. Our next article comes from the Tucson Sentinel. It's entitled, Private Equity Snaps Up Disability Services, Challenging State Regulators. PE firms have acquired more than 1,000 disability and elderly care providers in recent years. By Anna Claire Vollers, posted May 17, 2025. People with intellectual or developmental disabilities have suffered abuse, neglect, and even death while under the care of private equity-owned providers, according to a recent report from watchdog group Private Equity Stakeholder Project. The private equity firms are, more than any other type of investors, laser-focused on maximizing their cash flow, often trying to double or triple their investment over a relatively short period of time, usually just a handful of years, said Eileen O'Grady, the report's author. The way that private equity firms will often do that is to cut costs. For companies that provide essential services for people with disabilities, she said, those cuts can have really harmful impacts on people's lives. In late 2023, Florida moved to revoke the license of NeuroRestorative, one branch of the private equity-owned health services company, Civita, which provides services for people with disabilities. State regulators cited repeated violations by NeuroRestorative and a failure to protect the rights of its clients to be free from physical abuse. Ultimately, the state opted not to revoke the license and fined the company $13,000 in a settlement. But in recent years, regulators have documented instances of patient harm at Civita's affiliates in multiple other states. In 2019, a U.S. Senate committee conducted a probe into the company's operations in Iowa and Oregon, following multiple reports of patient abuse and neglect. Any entity that receives taxpayer dollars, but especially those charged with caring for our fellow Americans who may have an intellectual disability, ought to be doing everything under the sun to ensure quality care and continually improve, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, an Iowa Republican, said in a statement in 2020 following his investigation. In a statement to Stateline, Civita did not address the sanctions directly, but avowed its commitment to providing services and supports to give people greater independence, regardless of their intellectual or physical challenges. In recent years, a handful of large private equity-owned companies, such as Civita, have snapped up hundreds of smaller providers of disability services, often community nonprofits, mom-and-pop businesses, and religious organizations, and rolled them into larger corporations. From 2013 to 2023, private equity firms acquired more than 1,000 disability and elder care providers, according to the report by the Private Equity Stakeholder Project. Cash cow. Private equity firms use pooled investments from pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, endowments, and wealthy individuals to buy a controlling stake in a company. They seek to maximize its value, often by cutting costs, and then sell it at a profit. Most of Civita's revenue comes from providing disability services. It operates companies in 40 states under various brands, including Mentor Network, NeuroRestorative, and REM. Savita is currently owned by private equity firms Centerbridge Partners and Vistria Group, which also own Help at Home, a home health company with more than 200 locations across about a dozen states. Nearly all of Savita's revenue comes from Medicaid, according to a February 2025 report from S&P Global. Through Medicaid and Medicare, the government pays for most services for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. The two programs cover services such as group homes, adult day programs, in-care home, and physical and occupational therapy. Savita has been owned by private equity firms for over a decade now and has been under investigation and scrutiny at the federal and state level for basically that entire time, O'Grady said. In 2022, Iowa fined a neuro-restorative group home $10,500 after a resident was left unattended in a liquor store and drank 3/4 of a bottle of vodka. The same year, Massachusetts temporarily removed Savita's license to operate group homes after regulators reported inadequate staff training and supervision and a myriad of issues that were uncovered on site, according to a Massachusetts Department of Developmental Services report. The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has fined a neuro-restorative facility in Utah 4 times since 2022. A February 2024 inspection report by the agency found the facility failed to prevent abuse, neglect, and exploitation of residents. Last year, Florida fined another Savita brand, Florida Mentor, for improper use of restraints. More issues have been documented in Savita-owned locations in Arkansas, California, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, New Hampshire, and Nevada. Meanwhile, Savita's owners, Centerbridge and Vistria, have collected nearly $500 million since 2019 by loading Savita and Help at Home with debt in order to pay dividends to investors, according to Moody's, the financial services company. Similar financial maneuvering contributed to the recent collapse of Steward Healthcare, a private equity-owned hospital system that once had more than 30 hospitals nationwide. Steward has become a cautionary tale about the harm that profit-driven private equity firms can do to a state's health system. Before Steward Healthcare ultimately collapsed, executives spent years hiding their financial information from state regulators, putting patients and our healthcare system at risk, Massachusetts Democratic House Speaker Ron Mariano said in a statement earlier this year, announcing a new state law that beefs up reporting and financial requirements for private investors. That's why ensuring that our institutions are equipped to monitor the healthcare landscape and to guard against trends and transactions that drive up costs without improving patient outcomes is so important. David versus Goliath. After two residents of a New Jersey group home died from choking on food in 2017, attorney Corey Bernstein became interested in private equity's involvement in disability services. The residents had been living in homes operated by AdvoServe, a company that then owned by the private equity firm Wellspring Capital Management. The state had cited AdvoServe more times than any other operator in New Jersey for abuse, neglect, and unsafe conditions. AdvoServe later ceased operation in 2019 after multiple state agencies, including New Jersey, Florida, and Maryland, launched investigations. But even when state regulators are doing all they can to protect people with disabilities from substandard care, they're limited in how much they can hold a company accountable, Bernstein told Stateline. It's state-level oversight on a national entity with not much help coming from the federal side, said Bernstein, who is now a staff attorney at the National Disability Rights Network, a membership organization of federally mandated state disability advocacy programs. States just don't really have the resources or tools to do what needs to be done. A regulatory agency in Georgia might shut down all the group homes owned by a certain company, for example, but those regulators can't do anything about the company's abuses in, say, Montana. With branches in multiple states, a company is better able to withstand sanctions or even a loss of license in one state, he said. States are not set up to go up against a national operator with billions of dollars in resources in a regulatory or oversight battle, Bernstein said. Further complicating things for state regulators and for consumers is that a large services company such as Civita might operate under multiple brand names, even in one state. It can be hard to parse out who owns a sanctioned business. Multiple brand names can also obscure a company's monopoly on a particular regional market. When Florida regulators reached a settlement agreement with Civita's NeuroRestorative last year, the state dismissed its proposed license revocation. O'Grady believes one reason the state chose to settle is the difficulty of finding alternative facilities to relocate the residents who would have been displaced from the 13 locations the company operated around the state. Because of that dearth of alternatives and the impotence of the state to act more fully, this company will continue to be allowed to operate, she said. Further complicating oversight, large companies often operate various services that are overseen by different agencies. Group homes might be regulated under the state's Medicaid program, while facilities that provide more intensive care might come under federal Medicare oversight. There could be two completely different oversight systems for facilities serving the same population in the same state with the same name, Bernstein said. State solutions. Some states have moved to address problems with private equity involvement in healthcare by passing tighter restrictions on mergers and acquisitions of healthcare companies. In Rhode Island, where private equity companies' mismanagement of healthcare providers threatened the future of local hospitals, a robust oversight law allowed the state attorney general to impose conditions to protect the hospital's finances. More states are following suit. In 2023 alone, 24 states enacted laws related to health system consolidation and competition, while this year, at least half a dozen have considered legislation to check private equity-fueled healthcare mergers. And that's our program for this time. Thanks for joining us. Tune in to the Disability News Program again next time.